This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says half of all adults in the United States have now received at least one COVID shot. We get more from AP correspondent Ben Thomas.
President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, tells ABC's This Week,
I believe we'll get back with it and it...
And elation marked the opening of a long-awaited anticipated travel bubble between Australia and New Zealand.
Due to rare but serious issues with blood clots.
The pause was to take a look, make sure we know all the information we can have within that time frame, and also warn some of the physicians out there who might see people, particularly women, who have this particular adverse event, that they treat them properly.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
The start of the quarantine-free travel in New Zealand and Australia kicked off. It was a relief for families who have been separated by the coronavirus pandemic, as well as to struggling tourist operators. It is a tentative step toward the both countries. Hope will be a gradual reopening to the rest of the world. The idea of a bubble between Australia and New Zealand has been discussed for months, but faced setbacks. India's chief minister is now urging the federal government to provide more hospital beds to tackle the COVID crisis after the capital, New Delhi, recorded more than 25,500 coronavirus cases within a 24-hour period. With about one in three people testing, turning a positive result. This is VOA News. In Egypt, officials now say at least 11 people have died, and there are dozens of injuries after four train carriages derailed in a province just north of Cairo. The investigation into the cause continues. More than 50 ambulances took the injured to three hospitals in the province. The derailment is the latest of several recent railway crashes in Egypt. At least 20 people were killed and nearly 200 injured in March when two trains collided about 440 kilometers south of Cairo. During a television interview with the BBC, Russia's ambassador to Britain said Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny will not be allowed to die in prison and accused him of attention-seeking. Speaking to BBC's Andrew Marr, Ambassador Andrei Kellen said Navalny behaved like a hooligan and was trying to violate every rule that has been established. On Sunday, also, Navalny's daughter called on Russian authorities to allow a doctor to treat her father in prison. This is a day after a group of medical professionals warned he is not at risk of kidney failure. Russia jailed Navalny for 2.5 years in February for parole violations he said were fabricated. He was arrested in January when he returned to Russia from Germany, where he had been recovering from a nerve agent poisoning attack that he blamed on Russian President Vladimir Putin. The George Floyd case is expected to head to the jury Monday after closing arguments. We get more from AP correspondent Julie Walker.
There's no time limit for those closing arguments. Prosecutors go first, then defense, followed by rebuttal from prosecution. Then the jurors get to decide the case. They will be sequestered while they deliberate. The prosecution contends Derek Chauvin's knee on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds was to blame. The defense argues the former officer used reasonable force and Floyd's drug use and heart killed him. Jurors decide the three charges, second and third degree murder and second degree manslaughter, separately and must be unanimous on each charge. I'm Julie Walker.
Officials in Niger are reacting after at least 19 people were killed in the country's troubled region near the border with Mali after gunmen aboard motorcycles attacked a village. Government said Sunday that the suspected Islamic extremists shot at worshippers as they prayed at the mosque Saturday evening during the holy month of Ramadan. More at VOAnews.com via remotes. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 19, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's president fires his labor minister for misusing COVID-19 funds.
The president has fired him because the president has said that the usage of the money was not only inappropriate and irregular, but also it prevented those funds from being used in the fight against COVID.
Meanwhile, Malawi's former president accuses the government of politically persecuting him. Uganda responds to U.S. travel ban on some Ugandan government officials. Gambia's main opposition denies complicity for alleged marijuana found in one of its vehicles. And Cape Verdeans count votes in Sunday's parliamentary elections that could make history.
If the new Afromad and her party wins the election, there will be a new chapter, if you will, in the electoral politics of Gabon. For the first time, we would have a female prime minister.
And the UN Refugee Agency expresses concern about Botswana deporting Zimbabwe refugees. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi's president, Lazarus Chakwera, sacked his labor minister for misuse of COVID-19 money. The president fired Minister Ken Kandodo during a nationwide speech Sunday night on COVID-19. Particularly, he said, at a time when Malawi is experiencing a second wave of the virus. On the line from Lilongwe is Sean Kampondeni, Director of Communications for President Lazarus Chakwera. Good morning, Sean, and thank you for joining us on Daybreak Africa. What is the story?
Good morning, James, and thanks for having me. Yes, it is true. President Lazarus Chakwera has fired the labor minister. The background to this is that the month of February, the president had ordered a forensic audit into how 6.2 billion Malawi kwacha intended for the fight against COVID was used. That audit report has just been completed a few days ago, and the labor minister was named in that audit report as having spent close to just a little under $1,000 of COVID funds for his allowances on a foreign trip that had nothing to do with the COVID fight. The usage of the money was not only inappropriate and irregular, but also it prevented those funds from being used in the fight against COVID. And there was a lot of anger across the country at the misuse of COVID funds because, as you know, Malawi has been hit by a second wave since the beginning of the year.
So, Sean, the president said that besides the dismissal of the labor minister, that there were some people at the office of the president and cabinet who were also arrested. Who are those people, particularly in the office of the president, and what exactly is their connection?
Yes, one individual was named by the audit report as having facilitated certain procurements of supplies to the office of the president and cabinet. He is an administrator, I believe, and the police picked him up earlier in the day because this was part of a number of arrests that law enforcement agents are making as they comb through the audit report and identify individuals within the state machinery that have been implicated or are suspected of criminal conduct.
The Labor Minister Kandodo said that I think he has repaid the money and was apparently surprised by his dismissal. So COVID-19 funds, I wonder what's the feelings now among Malawians hearing this news?
Yes, it is true that the labor minister returned the funds, but the president has made the case that the funds were spent in November and were returned in February. And in between those months, we had the second wave of the pandemic, which decimated the country, which means that at the material time that the money was needed most to assist in saving lives, the money was not available because it had been spent by the labor minister on allowances.
Sean Kampondeni is Director of Communications for Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera. You are speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe.
Malawi's former president, Peter Mutharika, has accused the government of politically persecuting him during a televised news conference at his residence in Magoji district on Saturday. Mutharika cited the freezing of his bank accounts and arrest of his party officials over corruption allegations as examples. Government authorities say they are only following the law. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Mutharika, who lost to President Lazarus Chakwera during last year's elections, faces legal action for administrative blunders committed when he was in office. The latest is the case in which he is expected to pay about $87,000 in legal fees by wrongly forcing Chief Justice Andrew Nyirenda and Justice of Appeal Edward Tweya on leave during his administration. And in August, Malawi's Anti-Corruption Bureau froze bank accounts of Mutharika and his wife Gertrude as part of investigations into his role in a scandal in which bags of cement worth about $6.6 million entered the country without being taxed. Various efforts by Mutharika's lawyers to have his bank accounts unfrozen have proven unsuccessful. Mutharika told reporters the freezing of his accounts is persecution of the highest form.
The aim is simply to create hardship for me. Even the account where my retirement is supposed to come in, that account is closed. So my retirement benefits cannot come in. The idea to squeeze me, to make me totally incompetent financially, to make it impossible for me to support the DPP, and therefore to destroy the DPP and create a one-party dictatorship.
Mutharika banged on the table and asked the government to end what he called a tendency of prosecuting former presidents.
Persecuting former heads of state has got to stop in this country. It doesn't happen anywhere else. It doesn't happen in Zambia, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Tanzania, Rwanda, or anywhere else. It's only in this country. When this stupidity continues to go on, I want it to stop.
Latim Matenje is a political analyst with the Political Science Association of Malawi. He says Mutharika is justified to think that the government is persecuting him, considering the time his accounts have been frozen.
From any perspective, freezing the accounts of somebody right from August up to April, I mean, it's inhuman. One would wonder, what is that person eating? So for him to claim that, I'm not surprised.
Matenje says the government can prove Mutharika is wrong by letting him access his bank accounts as the probe into the case progresses. Matenje, however, faulted Mutharika for making similar comparisons to a former president.
The call itself is justifiable, but not from him. It's surprising it's him doing so, because he did the same to Dr. Joyce Banda. She left Malawi. She went outside because of persecution in here.
In 2014, Banda, who was Mutharika's predecessor, fled the country after being implicated in what became known as the Cashgate scandal, in which government officials siphoned off millions of dollars of public money. Reacting to Mutharika's accusations, government spokesperson Gospel Kazako said Mutharika is wrong by alleging persecution. Kazako, who also serves as the Minister of Information, says the government is only following the laws of the country. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The Ugandan government has responded to U.S. travel restrictions on some Ugandan government officials for their alleged involvement in gross human rights violations and undermining democracy during Uganda's January 14 general election. Alima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Uganda government spokesperson Ofwono Opondo says the U.S. had yet to formally inform Uganda Saturday of visa restrictions being placed on the country. But in a statement Friday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said actions by the Ugandan government during the January presidential election process undermined democracy and respect for human rights. The secretary announced visa restrictions on people the U.S. believes to be responsible for or complicit in undermining the democratic process, including during the January 14th election and the campaign period that preceded it. President Yoweri Museveni won a sixth consecutive term in office, defeating several challengers, including the opposition lawmaker known as Bobi Wine, who disputes the election results and alleges election irregularities. In the statement, top U.S. diplomat Blinken cites cases of opposition candidates being routinely harassed, arrested, and held illegally without charge. He also references Ugandan security forces being responsible for the deaths and injuries of dozens of innocent bystanders and opposition supporters, along with violence against journalists. The top U.S. diplomat noted those actions represent a continued downward trajectory for the country's democracy and respect for human rights as recognized and protected by Uganda's constitution. Government spokesman Opondo challenged the U.S. action, saying the U.S. does not have credible evidence against government officials, describing the U.S. accusation as generalized collective guilt and collective punishment, which is contrary to what they believe in.
Surprisingly, they don't disclose. If they were honest, they should disclose specifically the names, the incidences, and the nature of offenses of these officials so that Ugandans know them. Secondly, so that the government of Uganda takes investigation and appropriate action if these officers indeed were the ones responsible.
The National Unity Platform, NUP party, whose members say they have been victims of alleged human rights violations, welcomed the U.S. action. NUP party spokesperson Joel Senyonyi says the party has identified 700 people it considers to be political prisoners in Uganda who are missing, and it will keep demanding for their release.
We are happy that the international community is beginning to hold Uganda accountable, that there are ramifications for violations of human rights. And once, you know, they escalate, then maybe the repercussions get to escalate as well. So it's a very welcome development to us.
The Forum for Democratic Change politician and opposition parliament chief whip, Ssemujju Nganda, is among the lawmakers demanding government accountability. He says even though the U.S. action, and it will only be effective if it moves to the next stage.
I don't want to invite sanctions, but I think if there is a record of violations, the Americans need to do something more tangible than just the symbolism of announcing travel restrictions to people who may not even want to travel to America in the next 5 to 10 years. So they need to do something that they have done to countries that are not following international norms of human rights and democracy.
Secretary Blinken warned that the U.S. could continue to evaluate additional action against individuals complicit in undermining democracy and human rights in Uganda, as well as their immediate family members. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 19. Cape Verdeans are counting votes from Sunday's parliamentary elections in which current Prime Minister Correa El Silva of the Movement for Democracy Party is seeking a second term. Ibel Jassi Amado is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Simmons University in Boston. He says Cape Verde could have its first female Prime Minister if Janira Hofer Amalda of the opposition PAICV Party wins the election.
First and foremost, as you know, this is another round of multi-party elections in Cabo Verde. The first multi-party democratic elections in Cabo Verde was back in 1991. So every 5 years or so, we do have elections in Cabo Verde. And being Cabo Verde a parliamentary democracy, it also determines who gets to sit or to be in the position of prime minister. It's very competitive. But a couple of things that I want to emphasize for this specific round. First and foremost, Cabo Verde, in effective terms, is a bipartisan system, meaning that effectively two parties can hope to win the majority of seats in the National Assembly and therefore form the government. Those two parties are MPD, the Movement for Democracy, and the PAICV, the African Party for Independence of Cabo Verde.
You mentioned these two political parties, and one of them is led by a female who, if she wins, can be the first prime minister of Cape Verde. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. PAICD is currently led by Janira Afolamad. If Janira Afolamad and her party win the election, she would be appointed Prime Minister of Cabo Verde by the President. Yeah, so if she wins the election, there will be a new chapter, if you will, in the electoral politics of Cabo Verde. For the first time, we would have a female prime minister.
What is at the center of this election in Cape Verde? We have COVID-19, we have economic matters. What are the voters voting on?
Oh, that's a great question. First and foremost, obviously, COVID still is a major topic. Those two parties, particularly the opposition party, is rallying the electorate against what they perceive to be wrong policies carried out by the government. They emphasize how the government's policies regarding the COVID crisis were perhaps not the best suitable and did not lead to the proper management of the crisis. The government, on the other hand, responds that they did the best they could in light of this global pandemic crisis, and they often pointed other cases in Europe, in North America, to emphasize how, even though they did the best they could, but the situation was truly catastrophic in other more advanced economies and advanced democracies. That's one topic. The other topic that is also at the bottom of electoral politics this year is corruption.
That was Abel Jassy Amado, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Simmons University in Boston, Massachusetts. Police in The Gambia have detained a man who they say was caught with an unspecified quantity of marijuana while driving a vehicle belonging to the main opposition United Democratic Party, the UDP. As Pandero Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina, the opposition UDP is denying complicity.
The driver linked to the incident was arrested by the newly formed anti-crime unit called Operation Zero Crime. Superintendent Lamin Jai is the spokesman for the Gambia Police Force.
Our officers were on the patrol and they came across this vehicle. And in fact, what happened was that they were attending to another individual riding a bicycle but carrying a bag. And so they were attending to that person. And so it was during this process when the vehicle came in, and immediately it saw that this is a patrol vehicle. Then it took a U-turn, tried to flee away from the scene.
According to the police, the driver, identified as one user for Jambang, tried to evade arrest, thereby damaging a police patrol car.
In fact, by the time they get to him, he had caused considerable damage to the patrol vehicle. But eventually, they have been able to get to him, and so a search was conducted, and some evidence of suspected cannabis was found in the vehicle, and so the driver was arrested.
Lawyer Alma Mittal is the spokesperson for the main opposition United Democratic Party, UDP.
We understand it's still under investigation, and the UDP KMC took a vehicle of theirs to the garage for repairs. And apparently overnight, one of the mechanics went away with the vehicle and was caught by the police. But I think the police are the best people to tell the story.
Tal has denied his party's complicity to the alleged drug seizure.
This mechanic is not a member of the UDP. I personally don't even know him. When I asked the chairman of KMC, how did this car get to the garage, he told me, well, the car broke down for a while. It was in repairs for an extended period of time.
The driver has been charged with destruction to property. His drug case has been forwarded to the Drug Law Enforcement Agency of the Gambia.
We are very confident that it has nothing to do with the UDP. It wasn't driven by UDP members.
Tal warns that it is premature for anyone to blame his party.
This attempt to score political points or to accuse political operators, quite frankly, I don't know if it is helpful or it makes anybody safe or better off.
Over 3 tons of cocaine was last year impounded in the West African country of the Gambia. The prime suspect domestic link to that incident is said to be on the run. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says it is concerned after Botswana deported 57 Zimbabwean refugees who had lived in the host country since 2008. The refugees failed to register for voluntary repatriation, which led to their forced removal late last week. Nkundise Dube reports from Habaroni.
The UNHCR's External Relations Officer, Kate Pond, says the refugees, irrespective of their status, have rights and could have been allowed to remain as permanent residents.
UNHCR remains concerned that Zimbabweans who've been in Botswana for over a decade have been removed to Zimbabwe in less than voluntary circumstances. Irrespective of their status, they still have certain rights. And UNHCR had aimed for alternative solutions, like those provided to Zimbabweans who have family links in Botswana and may be able to remain in the country as permanent residents.
One of the deported refugees, speaking on condition of anonymity, says they were rounded up Thursday and told to board a bus which took them to Zimbabwe's border.
We left Botswana on empty stomachs. We deported to the border where we didn't find any assistance. We wanted to remain in Botswana. That's why we did not register. We have nothing. We don't even know where to start because most of us have kids who are going to school. We're going to school in Botswana. So it will be difficult now without the papers like passport or identity cards.
The deportees have been living at the Duke refugee camp. Botswana's government had warned that refugees who did not register would be deported. Last month, Botswana sent back more than 200 other Zimbabweans who had registered for voluntary repatriation. The repatriated refugees had initially refused to do so, citing fears of persecution in their homeland. The UNHCR says it will continue to assist refugees who were repatriated. Each person received $520 and a food package. But the agency says there will be no such assistance for the deported refugees. Nkondisi Dube for VOA News, Habaroni.
For Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Netherlands, where Kenyan elite Kipchoge got back to winning ways as he won the NN Mission Marathon in 2 hours, 4 minutes, 30 seconds at the 20 airport in Eshende, Holland, 3 months before the Tokyo Olympic Games. The world record holder competed in the elite-only race with 70 runners, aiming to secure an Olympic qualifying time after the majority of races were cancelled or postponed due to the COVID-19 outbreak. The NN Mission Marathon was originally scheduled for April 11th in Hamburg, Germany, but the race was postponed to April 18th and relocated to a closed-looped course at 20 Airport because of rising COVID-19 cases in Hamburg. The 2016 Olympic Marathon champion finished more than 2 minutes ahead of his fellow Kenyan Corey, who clocked 2 hours, 6 minutes, 40 seconds.
The NN Mission Marathon, actually, this was the real test towards Tokyo Olympics. It's a real test, and it's a good marathon actually to happen even some few months towards the Olympics for to test your fitness. Above all is that the plans are going on. I'm going back to Kenya, talk to the right people to see how my trainings will be. But I have a good team. I have my good coach, good management, good technical team for consultation.
In cricket news, Cricket South Africa is at the risk of being suspended by the South African Sports Minister, Nathi Mtintuyawa, after the CSA failed to adopt a new governance structure at the weekend. The Members' Council voted against the adoption of amendment to the Memorandum of Incorporation during a special general meeting, which was meant to allow the appointment of a board with a majority of independent members, including an independent chairperson. Just 6 of the 14 affiliates voted in a secret ballot for the amendment. As a result, South African Sports Minister Nathi Mtintuyawa on Sunday indicated that he will exercise his right in terms of Section 13(5) of the Sports Act. The CSA has been embroiled in a whole lot of controversy and leadership crises in the last 1 year.
The national interest is trumped by parochial interests of individuals, cricket. That is why there's a mess in cricket today.
In football news, Nigerian international and Leicester City striker Kelechi Iheanacho's fine form continued as he fired the winner to book Leicester City a first FA Cup final appearance in 52 years after a 1-0 semi-final success over Southampton on Sunday. Iheanacho scored his 10th goal in his last 7 games in all competitions. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, April 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you will have a great week.